Bandwidth for this podcast is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twim.
This week on the show, Hulu does have a plot to take over the world. Don't trust the media and check your own darn facts. All this on This Week in Media, episode 137. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back. We took Memorial Day weekend off, and we're rested. Come back rested for the show. Sometimes Alex and I just, you know, sometimes we just have to pay bills, right?
It was, yeah.
And spend time with the family.
There's actually been a couple of, I came in and we did one, and it just didn't make it.
Did that one not make it? What has gotten into you? You can't do a show without me anymore. It's like anytime I'm gone and I leave the reins to you, even though you are the technically astute one amongst the pair of us, that has already been established. The show doesn't make it on the air.
It was an ugly scene. That's all I can say.
Okay.
So we're back.
So we've been off for 3 weeks then. Well, we missed two episodes.
We're back today.
That's what matters.
Not gonna miss any more.
We're back on track.
We're back on the wagon
for the summer.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see how we do next week, people. But anyway, thank you as always for those of you who are listening later on in the week on iTunes, on your computer, or wherever it is. We appreciate you joining us for This Week in Media. I'm Daisy Whitney. We have a wonderful lineup here today. And also those of you who are watching live on Leo Laporte's This Week in Technology Network, we are grateful to have you as well. And we have some terrific guests today. Very exciting.
I think, yes.
Maybe first-time guest? I don't know. Scott Sigler, have you been on the show before?
I have not been on this show before, no.
Yay! We have two first-time guests. But most of our listeners know you. I think many of our listeners are big fans of your work. Scott is an author and also is a well-known podcaster. Colleen just handed me Contagious. He writes really, really scary horror stories, horror novels, and also has podcasts, some of them. So, Scott, we're grateful that you're on. And now, do you have a new book that just came out?
I have a book. I've got Contagious and Infected, which came out from Crown Publishing, and then I'm kind of trying my own new media experiment here by publishing one called The Rookie, which I'm printing in hardcover, doing 3,000 copies myself and selling a limited edition from scottsigler.com. So that'll be out in September, and then the next book will be out in all the bookstores will be Ancestor, which will be out February next year.
So you still have your deal with Crown, and you're still going to do the traditional publishing route, but you're also doing the self-publishing route kind of to see how that works.
Yeah, I kind of write faster than they want to put books out, and they're also positioning me as kind of a mainstream horror thriller guy, but I'm also a big geek and write some science fiction stuff and all kinds of different things. They don't want to publish those things. Like, The Rookie is a pro football league set 700 years in the future, with aliens playing different position and organized crime and everything. It's kind of a different mashup of genres. They don't want to put that out, so it gives me the opportunity to put it out myself and see, you know, building up an audience online. If you can sell to your audience directly online right from your site, you cut out a lot of middlemen, and it goes a long way towards making a living as an author.
All right, cool. Well, I'm sure we'll get some great insight from you when we talk about what's going on with the Kindle and e-readers and stuff like that, and what you think about all of that, as well as the publishing business, because lots going on in that area. And also, Brian Brushwood. It's good to have you on the show, Brian. How are you?
I'm so excited to be here. I'm actually really impressed with the diversity of characters that you have on the show today. You've got people of all different types of talent, and then me, who represents the talentless fool, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, yes. It is you amongst us all who has the least amount of talent, Brian.
That's what magicians do. We just take credit for stuff we didn't actually do. We've got no talent. We got nothing.
Well, Brian is the host of Scam School, and I have had the pleasure of interviewing him for... on a couple episodes of my show, The New Media Minute, as well as for other projects that I work on. And it's been a lot of fun. I'm a big fan of his work. Scam School is all about social engineering at the bar and on the street, which basically means, you know, learn cool things to trick your friends and win free beer and all of that stuff. So Brian, you were talking about something. We're going to get into our ad in just a moment, but you were talking about something very interesting before we started the show about E3, because that's going on right now. And I'm officially dubbing you our E3 correspondent because you were watching some of the initial feeds and live coverage. What's sort of the big news so far? I mean, today is Monday, June 1st.
Well, I was watching, they streamed the live Microsoft press conference, and my favorite part was Cliffy B of Epic Games comes out. This is at the Microsoft press conference where they're showing off all the new games and new products coming out, and from Epic Games, Cliffy B comes rolling out wearing a t-shirt with Bill Gates' mugshot from when he was arrested, which I thought was delightful. I enjoyed that quite a bit.
It's a troublemaker, that Bill Gates. And so what's the big news so far? Any big news coming out of the show?
A lot of big news. They're doing an interesting entry into kind of try to tackle the space that the Wii owns with casual gamers. They've got this, I guess it's called Natal, Project Natal, where you don't actually have a controller. You just wave your arms around like a crazy person and play the game that way. It'll be interesting to see. It's out of context. It looks pretty silly, I'm not going to lie. But I thought the Wii looked pretty silly, and it ended up being a full-fledged phenomenon. So it'll be interesting to see how that works. And the other thing that surprised me was they somehow, I want to use the word stole. For years, the Metal Gear Solid game franchise has been tied heavily to Sony's games and products, and somehow Xbox got it. And I'd love to know if somebody was pissed off at somebody else or somebody paid somebody under the table or what. It's really interesting.
Well, that's how all deals work. Somebody gets paid under the table. We've got our tech stuff up and running, Alex, we have an ad. So let's talk about our sponsor.
Our sponsor. Of course, this is brought to you by Squarespace.com. And Squarespace is a huge service for us. We're moving a lot of our sites all over to Squarespace right now. And I think that actually... we have other people on the show that are using it. Brian, you're using this?
What's that, Squarespace? Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it so much, I ported my entire website over to it. And what's great about Squarespace is people think that it's just, first of all, they do have templates that look really, really kick-ass. So if you're somebody who doesn't like to take a lot of time, even if you like good-looking setups, you don't have to spend a lot of time doing them. But if you are one of those guys who just has to get hands-on with everything, they allow all custom CSS on there. We tricked out schwood.com, and it looks amazing, and it's all handled by Squarespace. And the real benefit to me is I'm on the road, I'm in a different city every night, and I don't have to even have my computer. I could go to any computer, just log in my credentials, and start editing on the fly while I'm on the road. I'm crazy about Squarespace.
Yeah, we did TwipLog. TwipLog is for This Week in Photography, and between Aaron Mailer and I, the two of us just back and forth, you know, we're able to work on it. And the fact that I could go in and make adjustments and color and layout and everything else is all stuff that is just that's the part that I hate. I want to be the content person who can also affect, you know, the way it's going to look. You know, now of course Squarespace lets you, you know, you have a blog module, you have forums, photo galleries, form builders, you can add Google Maps, you can do, you know, have members, you can, you know, but it's all, the great thing is it's a cloud architecture, so you're not worried about one server somewhere. It really is something that, you know, works for both people who are beginning and CSS experts. So,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you know what I haven't heard anyone talk about is the metrics that they have on Squarespace are phenomenal. You've checked those out, right?
Yeah, they are gorgeous.
They represent everything visually, so it's really easy to get a handle on where your traffic is coming from, and that's all included as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if people listening would like to check it out, go to squarespace.com/twim. That's squarespace.com/TWIM. You can sign up. You don't need a credit card. It's free. You can get a test piece that you can put up there and see how it works for you. If you decide you want to buy it, you use TWIM as the coupon code and you'll get 10% off. So go up to squarespace.com/TWIM. You can see it right there.
Let's talk about publishing a little bit. A couple of interesting stories came out late last week that we're going to get into. We're going to, just to kind of let people know what we're going to be doing on the show, obviously we've got our usual news stories. Many of you have been big fans of the segment we started recently, which is Blend Tech Your Business, which is where we listeners write in. They usually write to me and I kind of bring the suggestions and just to give a little bit of pre-prep for our guests and my esteemed co-host, Alex. So we've got a couple of Blend Tech Your Business segments where we give you a real quick tip on what you can do to kind of make your business pop with online video. So we're going to do that at the end. But a couple of interesting stories came out late last week. One is a Hulu desktop. And then the other is this this publishing story. It was reported in The Atlantic, Slate, and so on and so forth. And basically... There's just some really funny reporting on it. It was last week that apparently the newspaper industry, Gannett, McClatchy, Hearst, Media News, AP, Philadelphia Media Holdings, and so on, sort of all these big newspaper holding companies, apparently had some kind of secret meeting, you know, which sounds like one of those, you know, secret mob meetings, right? Or you know, you can sort of picture like the Monopoly Railroad type of guys getting together and meeting. And who knows? I guess what they're trying to figure out really is the big issue is, can the newspaper business survive? Scott, I thought I would sort of throw this one to you because you're the one who's most closely related to the publishing business. I know this is primarily about newspapers. And I don't know that much is necessarily known, but what's your take on this kind of meeting of the collective minds in the newspaper business to try to figure out how to save their business or what the future of it is?
Well, it's encouraging that they're all actually getting together, whether it's legal or not for them to get together in this manner. But, you know, newspapers are in a world of hurt right now, and they're really sleeping in the bed that they made for themselves over the year. And, you know, who knows what's going to come out of this? This you're actually looking at major papers failing in real time, and something like this could sort of be the last gasp of newspapering as we know it. What's going to come out of this? Who knows? You know, who knows whether the newsprint industry is going to survive that much longer? But you know, until it comes out what they've actually decided to agree, if they've got some kind of a agreement on competition, they're trying to work together to reduce costs, etc. It's really just more conglomeration and more people building together instead of the newspaper, say, branching off on their own and trying to find a local niche in which they can be competitive.
I wonder if it's kind of like the car makers, you know, I mean, do we think newspapers are in as dire a strait as the car makers? And is this meeting similar to, obviously the sort of the big meeting that was reported on late last year, or I'm sorry, it was earlier this year. And of course, today is the day GM officially filed for bankruptcy. But earlier this year, we had the three heads of the big car companies going before Congress.
Well,
you
know, one thing that I find
interesting.
Well, one thing that I find interesting is, you know, we don't hear a lot of people saying that the New York Times is too big to fail. You know, like you know, or that these. I find it interesting that for a country that considers the press as integral mm-hmm. to making it work.
To the Constitution.
There's not a lot of...
I don't see cars mentioned in the Constitution anywhere.
Right, people seem to care more. Yes, but the government seems to care more about saving the automakers than something that's you know, holding up
right.
the First Amendment, theoretically, right?
Right. Well, maybe they've decided that it's not. You know, maybe they've decided that, you know, they're going to let it change the way it's going to change, which in many cases might be good, what was good for the automakers, too. But...
I wonder, though, if, and we're just obviously purely speculating at this point, if a next step could be that could come out of this meeting is asking for government help.
Well, they're doing is they're sitting together and they're realizing that the pricing of the problem with the newspapers, that the pricing is broken. And if they could repair or fix the price and they could all agree to fix the prices together, then clearly it would be better for everyone, right?
No, but Brian, what do you mean by fixing the prices? And when you say it's broken, are you saying, I mean, are you talking about just that, you know, the Sunday Times is $6.
Well,
is that what you mean?
They're giving away their content for free online, and they're going to get together to see how they can either all agree to charge for that at the same time, at the same rate, or they're going to try and find other ways to bring in revenue in which they can all work together. That the irony of this is, as they're facing such a difficult decision, a meeting like this indicates they are foregoing competition and all trying to monopolize together so that they can all stay afloat instead of, you know, open market, let's have at it and see who has the best ideas and it wouldn't be a winner take all in an industry like this. Somebody comes up with a new idea, brings in revenue, the others can copy it, but they're totally circumventing that altogether. They want to work together, level the playing field so that everybody's charging and making the same thing, and there really is no more competition. It becomes one newspaper organization.
Well, and I think this brings up, you know, all kinds of antitrust problems.
Yes,
I mean, you know, to I mean, this is a lawyer's dream, You know, to see them doing this, because you know, once the meeting, once the meeting actually happens, if they suddenly change everything at the same time, you know that there are going to be lawsuits.
So who sues them, Alex? I mean, because I think that's definitely a viable point. But who where would the lawsuits come from?
You could have blog networks, you know, other online news sources, so on and so forth. That, you know, citizens. I mean, you're talking about a class action lawsuit.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know that people who are saying that this is going to remove. You know, it's illegal. I mean, you know, literally no one has to sue anybody. I mean, what they're doing, if they do it together, is just something that the Department of Justice gets involved with.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I mean,
it's
this
called
is
monopoly.
Not, yeah, well, yeah, it's
monopolistic behavior.
You know, it's monopolistic behavior, you know, and so they're really, and now I think that the issue is that they are concerned that, you know, the problem that they have is that if I can get the same news, if the New York Times makes it, charges for it, but I can get the same news from CNN, the newyorktimes.com will be gone. You know, because I'm not going to, you know, it's hard enough. When I link to articles in my lists, you know, for people to watch, people don't want to go to New York Times because they have to register. I mean, you know, like they go, oh, I was going to go look at that, but then I had to register to look at that
article.
And
it's free.
It is free. And I register.
I've been registered for so long,
yeah.
I don't think about it. Yeah, you're right. Good point.
But you have to register. People complain about that, let alone, you know, people are going to start, you know, you're going to start paying for it, you know, and that's like, and I have to admit, I had a subscription to the Wall Street Journal for a long time, and then it dropped off, and then I had to subscribe, or I had to pay for an online subscription to do it, and I was like,
a lot of those articles too, you'll just see the first two or three paragraphs, and if you Google the headline, you won't always find it in other places, but you will often find it in Reuters or Dow Jones Newswire or where it is. All either you'll get the article someplace else that's picked it up that it's syndicated to. But let's talk about pricing for just a second, because obviously there is clearly the broader issue of, you know, online pricing, giving the content away for free, like a New York Times does, and where it's ad supported, or like a Wall Street Journal where it's more of a subscription model. And everyone's experimenting with this. I mean, I even saw an a newsletter ad last week for GigaOM offering, I think, $79 a year for all sorts, which would basically be market research all throughout the year. So, I mean, everyone is experimenting with pay models. But what I found was interesting was a story in this blog, I think Washington Biz Journal, that the New York Times is increasing newsstand prices for its daily and its Sunday edition. And basically, so in Washington, D.C., the Sunday Times goes to $6, up from $5.
Wow.
And what I guess... You know,
yeah, but
this is
thing.
Like
here's,
the Band-Aid analogy. Here's,
but I'll say one thing about it.
Okay.
Is that when I buy a paper at a newsstand, I will admit that I am fairly price. I'm not very price sensitive. You know, like
same way. I'm the same way, because the only time I'm buying something on Dead Tree Edition is when I got to get on a plane and I want to be able to read something during takeoff and landing. And I don't care if it's,
I mean, I buy a collection of magazines, you know, before I get on a plane. This is exactly what
magazines are usually $6.
Yeah. Well, and I buy two or three of them. I spend $15 or $20 on a flight for my reading materials, you know, and that's a pretty typical thing.
So that's
thing
a fair point.
OK,
so basically newsstand prices don't really matter because
they matter. They matter to me. $6 is lunch. I don't know, you know, swing over to McDonald's, get the Happy Meal, you're in good shape. $6 is getting really up there.
But the
they're
question
basically
is that...
They're foregoing a large portion of the marketplace in order to get more revenue out of the people who will pay for it.
Here's what you got to remember as well. There's a phenomenal amount of content in one weekend edition of a newspaper, and I forget which newspaper it was. Around the turn of the century, they were being accused of having too many ads, and what they did to combat that was they released every Sunday along with their Sunday newspaper. You could either buy the regular edition for, you know, a nickel or whatever, or you could buy the deluxe edition, which was the exact same newspaper but with no ads. And hardbound as a book. It was the size of a novel, and it was all the same articles, just printed up without the ads. And so I think people don't realize how much content you get for $6. And especially, you know, I mean, especially compared to magazines. I think magazines are so much more expensive than you're looking at for a newspaper.
It's not a question of how much content you get, though. The real question is all of that same information that you're paying $6 for is out there somewhere for free. So it's not just that you're paying $6 for excellent reporting and excellent content, which is probably worth it in the larger context. Your competition is the internet, and that exact same content and the same stories are free. At that point,
well, and I think that,
$6 for the content's tough.
But I think the people buying it at the newsstand, and I think this is the issue, not on a daily basis, because I haven't picked up a paper you know, to I pick one up.
When did you buy and go shopping at the newsstand?
I do.
Alex?
I have.
Unless it was The Economist.
No. Well, I mean, I've gotten, so I'll pick up like the New York Times, like if I'm at a convention or something like that, and it's in the morning, and I'll. And a lot of times it's just sitting outside my door, you know. But if it's not, I might pick one up so I can sit there and read the paper. But I have to admit, like for a Sunday paper, what I do, the first thing I used to do, every Sunday morning I'd walk down the hill. I lived in
when you were in the city.
In the city, mm-hmm. And I'd walk down the hill and I'd buy my Sunday paper and I'd sit there and have a latte. But the first thing I would do is I would literally just go through the magazine, and there was only certain sections I was interested in. So I would go through and I'd grab the four or five sections I'm interested in and put the rest of it in recycling. You know, just move it. I would do it immediately because I didn't want to deal with all the whatever. I would just separate the whole thing out. And what I found interesting is that even though there's a lot of information there, I only want five sections. Sure. And then I only want four articles in each section. You know, like there's, you know, I'm very specific about, I'm not going to read the whole paper. I think that gets into, I mean, it's an enormous waste of paper, number one. But I think it also, you know, gets into this thing. Like for me now, I have to admit, I'm getting very comfortable with sitting there reading a coffee with my iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, I sit there with my iPhone and I sit there and I don't go to their web version. I go to like New York, because the New York Times web version I don't like that much. But the actual, I mean, not the web version, the iPhone version of the New York
Times.
Where
it's delivered to you. Like, is it an app?
Well, I don't know. There's one that it'll want to send you to, but I just go to the regular web page on my iPhone. And I find that I can double click on it and I get the row and I just sit there and just scroll through it and I can watch it, and it's just much more convenient. This isn't a money thing for me. This is literally, it is more convenient for me to sit there and look at my iPhone and scroll with my little finger than have to deal with all that paper. You know, and once you get used to it, and I think that if this new, and the Kindle is something that a lot of people are starting to use for this, if this new Apple, whatever, you know, the MediaPad actually comes out, you know, I'm never going to read another newspaper ever.
You know what? I have to say, as many of you know, I get my New York Times on the Kindle now, and I'm embarrassed to admit this. I read it less than when I got the Sunday paper edition. Even though I thought, even though it's definitely the environmentally correct choice, and even though I think it's a good thing for me to be doing, just as somebody who's in the media business, to be trying out these new models and what they're like, so that way I can talk about it here and in other places, I don't read it as much because it's that... And it's not, the Kindle's not hard to use. I love the Kindle. I mean, everybody, you guys know that I'm a Kindle fan.
There's a certain level of serendipity that doesn't occur.
Yeah, exactly, Alex. That's it. It's, you've got the paper in front of you. You see it on the coffee table or wherever it is. You pick it up. Oh, wow, that's a fascinating story that I never would have sought out. When you have it on the Kindle and you have to decide what sections to go to, again, you have to be more active. You have to be making that choice. And one of my favorite things to read every Sunday is this column in the style section. It is hilarious. It's about social P's and Q's. I mean, people write in with the silliest questions. You know, like, is it okay for me today? You know, my boyfriend's ex-brother, but he really irritates me because he does this, this, and that. Should I tell him? I mean, it's just ridiculous, silly stuff. And the writer is just hilarious. I mean, I read it for that reason. And my husband knew it was my favorite thing to read every Sunday in the paper. And now that I don't remember to read it on the Kindle, because it was, I remembered it in the paper.
Right.
Kind of miss it. So, going on in the newspaper business. And I feel like, I don't know that I want to say we have a bit of a defeatist attitude on this show. I don't think it's germane to this show. I mean, I read stuff that Jeff Jarvis, who's a genius in this area, is writing. I don't know that anybody has come up with a good solution for the paper business. Has anyone?
Well, here's, if I may real quick, what we're seeing is, in my opinion, is we're seeing the dwindling down of one branch of the tree of media. And in this case, what are you really buying when you're buying a newspaper? What you used to be buying 30 years ago is you were buying the fastest, most up-to-the-date news you could buy. And that was worth whatever the money costs, right? Now, newspaper is a highly inefficient way. If what you want
it's literally yesterday's news.
Yeah, it is literally yesterday's news. So now, if you're going to, and in this case, in most places, you don't even have to pay. I guess you have to pay for internet access. You have to pay for your Wi-Fi or whatever. But if what you want is up-to-the-minute news, newspaper's not going to be your first place to go. Now, if what you want is an aesthetic experience, the experience of sitting down with your cup of coffee and the crinkle and the smell and all that stuff, then that's fine. But there's got to be a different price for that. And I don't think that price is the same amount as if you're selling the latest news.
Well,
to everyone.
And I had we had this discussion. Quinn, who works at our office, you know, is from New York, and he said that there is a, you know, when you get on Long Island Railroad, of people going into the city, you know, and these are business folks and they're all dressed and they have their New York Times or their Wall Street Journal. And there is a way that the way that newspaper is printed is so that it can be folded over. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain right. And there's this pattern of folding the thing that you go and you fold it and then you can unfold it and fold it to get to whatever else you're reading. And there's a whole science to it. And his point was, is that that's never going to change. You know, like those the people who do that are going to keep on doing that forever. Now, the problem is that that's one generation.
Right.
That's never going to change. You know, and the real problem is that as you look at a new generation who never read the newspaper, you know, and don't really know, like, I don't expect my kids to be reading the newspaper.
No, if my son reads it, he'll be reading it on the Kindle. My father recently retired from the news business. He worked at CBS News for most of his career, worked on, you know, many of the shows there. And now he is... he's teaching at actually where Brian lives in Austin. He's teaching at University of Texas at Austin in the communications department, and he's teaching news writing. And of course, writing is something, I mean, that's a core skill, obviously, that you need for whatever type of journalism that you're going to be doing, whether it's on air or even podcasting or whatever it is. You need to know how to write. And he says, I don't envy the students who are graduating now. He goes, I am glad I graduated in 1967. Right. It was just, I mean, the journalism business. And you know, I'm experiencing it right now. I don't know if we've talked about it much on the show. We don't need to go into it in detail. But Television Week, you know, which I had written for, it was, you know, one of my clients, one of my publications for 10 years, became online only today. It ceased print publications. So I'm not really affiliated with TV Week anymore. So, but yeah, it was much better to be a journalist back in the 60s and 70s than it is today. Other things that are going on today, though, that I think are worth noting is this Hulu desktop app. So late last week, Hulu launched Hulu Desktop, which is essentially kind of like Juiced on Hulu or Hulu on Juiced or whatever you want to call it. I mean, Hulu clearly has been known.
Hulu of using steroids.
Exactly. It's sort of a strange, I mean, it's a strange idea. It kind of reminds me of NBC Direct. It kind of reminds me of, you know, Juiced started as a download service and then migrated to a browser one. Hulu started as a browser service, obviously is still at its core, is going to be a browser-based streaming service. But essentially what you can do is have Hulu running on your desktop, but apparently it doesn't enable video downloads or transfer to any other devices. So it's not as if Hulu just married iTunes and you've got the capability of all that.
I tested it.
Yeah. Well, then, so what do you think?
It's pretty good.
I got some feedback from listeners, too. Okay, so what do you think?
It's pretty good. There's some weird interface stuff, it's a good first start. I felt like there were lots of weird little interface things and overlays, and it was hard to get to some stuff. You know, typical, like, we're just trying to figure out what we're doing. But overall, I thought it was good. I think that one of the advantages of doing this is people like me. I have in my office house that's like behind the main house. I have a Mac Mini, and the Mac Mini is really my server for, you know, everything that I watch while I'm working out and doing stuff like that. That's pretty much when I watch, you know, TV. And so and right now what that has is my iTunes with Front Row, and occasionally I'll watch, you know, some streaming video, but it's a kind of a pain because I don't really want to use the web, you know, to do that. So by going into an application, we can really, it's a first step.
Here's the thing that kind of blows me away is they sort of took this totally chicken approach to it. And personally, I've got this conspiracy theory that Hulu is ready to take over your living room television, but at the same time, they're being funded and they're under the thumb of big media. So they kind of pull these half-assed, halfsy things. Like, for example, clearly the benefit to installing Hulu Desktop is so you could sit on your couch and use a remote, but they don't want to say that. They don't want to market that.
Right.
So instead, if you read the marketing, it's like, we finally provide a lean-back experience. You're still at your desk. You better be at your desk because you better not use this in front of your living room, but you can lean back. We saved you 3 feet is essentially what they're saying. So I don't know. I mean, and the worst part is the way they expressly forbid putting it on an Apple TV. You guys saw that?
No.
Yeah, yeah, but you can access it apparently with an Apple remote, because one of our listeners wrote into me when he suggested, you know, and I always do a call out for story topics, and this is David Wheeler, so thank you. I always like to give our listeners credit. He you know, similar to you, Alex, he likes it out initially, understands that it's in beta, but he said you can use the Apple remote with it. You can access profiles on it, easy access to your queue. He likes the look of the interface. And, you know, it's just kind of what you're saying. You don't have to open a browser. So in your case, if you're working out, that's a nice feature. You know, when we came in here today, Colleen, similar to what Brian just said, okay, let me, Hulu is taking over the world. Similar sort of feeling as Brian has in that regard.
Yeah, I wish they were unfettered to do so legitimately and just actually go ahead and tackle the set-top living room box. And instead, you could just tell this has big media's thumbs all over it, just squishing, keeping the man down. That's what Hulu's having to deal with.
And I have to say, I'm so close to, you know, completely. Even my wife now is starting to move closer and closer to just cutting the cable cord. She's
You're
got the cable.
You're going to do it again? You cut the cable cord before. She's got cable
in.
Back.
She's got cable in the house, okay. And I have in my office. All I have is the internet connection.
Okay. Daisy, you cut cable, didn't you?
Yes, for near almost a year now. Last October,
yeah.
When we moved to the new house, we cut the cable as well, and you know, we bothered to set up stuff to make it easy to use the PC in the living room, but most people haven't. No regrets, no looking back.
And she's got my you know, in the house, it's a little bit of an R&D thing. So you have the cable box, but you have a PlayStation for the Blu-rays or whatever. But then you have the Apple TV. She's got the Apple TV hooked in, and then she's got she's also got a Roku, which is awesome. You know, so she can download Netflix.
Yep.
And like, you know, for instance, we like Law and Order. It's a guilty pleasure. I went up to Netflix and just, you know, put in my queue like all the last 9 seasons of Law and Order. So whenever she feels like she wants to watch a Law and Order, she doesn't have to find it anymore. She can just go up to Netflix and
now what
and,
I want to know, it. Alex, is I know that your wife was one of the reasons when you moved to Petaluma that you got cable
Oprah.
Service again.
She just wants to watch Oprah. No, like literally. If the thing is that there's only two linchpins that keep the cable
so
in the house.
So when Oprah goes internet only.
No. There's two linchpins. I use the DVR to record Alton Brown, Good Eats. That's the only show that I really watch on TV at this point. I mean, like a TV, like I actually have to. And so, but I DVR it. So I have like 15 Good Eats, you know, at any one time. And my son, who's 18 months old, it turns out the only show the two of us can watch.
Here's my question for you, though. Yeah, the serious question is, because, you know, I mean, look, on this show, we always try to strike a balance. I mean, we're a little bit more futuristic in our media consumption habits. I actually had a really interesting conversation with Scotty Asseri, one of our listeners. We had an email conversation about this kind of, you know, sometimes we apologize for being in the bubble. And the conversation Scotty and I were having is, you know, should we apologize for the bubble or just admit, like, hey, we're kind of a futuristic show? I mean, Brian's got a TriCaster in his house, Scott podcast.
How many people outside of the bubble are watching this right now?
Yeah, well, but here's the interesting point, Scott. And this surprises me is that we have a lot of listeners who are really interested in sort of the future of media and media business mm-hmm. models, which is why they tune into this show, but also really like traditional TV, you know, like having cable to watch sports, to watch football, to watch, you know, just the cable shows
right.
that you
yeah.
can't well, get and, online and, yet. So it's interesting. So we always try to kind of strike
right.
a balance,
and I will
or at
admit,
least acknowledge
I
that.
I will admit, by accident yesterday, I don't watch tennis very often. But I know kind of who they are, you know, and I go by and, you know, they had this huge thing with Nadal yesterday, lost at the French Open, which is like a big deal, evidently. But knowing that he was losing, I have to admit that I watched it. You know,
so
I sat there and watched
it. It's a serendipity. It's the same idea as having New York Times.
There's a certain level
house.
Of serendipity. It's yeah. very rare for me to do that. It just happened to be that, like, literally, it happened because the Good Eats ran out and I hadn't started up another one. And I just saw this thing. And so, but it is, that's the kind of thing that once I knew that he lost, I wouldn't have watched.
It's funny that you mentioned that because I was thinking the same thing when you were saying Law and Order is a guilty pleasure. There's a lot of guilty pleasure. Pleasures that I will watch if they happen to be on a TV. The only time I even see a television is in a hotel, but I would never on purpose click on them. You know, like I am choosing to watch this show right now.
And that's true. That is the thing, that there's a lot of things that we just end up falling into.
Right.
And there's the sports is the big thing you brought up earlier. I mean, NBA playoffs are going on right now. NFL's coming up. Not a big baseball fan, but I watch a lot of soccer as well. If there's a place to go get that stuff on demand, I don't know what it is, but at least with the sports factor, you're talking about live. The drama is in the live viewing, and if that's something that's going to, you know, if they're going to be able to stream live sporting events,
Well, and
that'd be
and
the only thing to make me cut the cable.
And the NFL is starting to experiment with that. So we saw last season the NFL where they're starting to stream these, and they're giving you multiple angles. And this is where the online thing
looks good.
It looks good. Really good. You know, it's this big flash player, and it. But you can change from six different angles, and I don't have to wait for them to change. I can sit there and just boom, 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 and change those angles, and still listening to the same audio feed. It is that kind of stuff is going to. You know, keep on building. And that's where, you know, there are so many places that online can take TV, you know, in the same way that we're seeing this in print. Print is hitting the ground first, but I think TV is soon, you know, close behind it, you know. And to get back to like at Alton Brown, it's pretty usual for me to be sitting on my laptop while I'm watching TV. I sit with it. So here's the thing is I'm usually on my laptop watching TV because I don't feel like TV is enough information at one time. Like it's, I need
you can play
else.
Music too, Alex.
No, I don't play music.
Okay. You just stick but to I'll be two, surfing, two but I'm sources surfing. Of stimulation.
I'm surfing the web while I am notorious for buying stuff while watching Alton Brown. So I'll sit there and I'll search. He'll be using something and I'll be sitting there going, how much does that cost? And I'll be up on Amazon. Next thing you know, showing up tomorrow on my Amazon Prime. You know,
stuff you see on the show?
And he should be making money with that. If he's online, he should make 4% out of every one of the people like me doing that order. And he could if it was online.
If it was tied into it. Scott, go ahead. You were going to say something?
I was going to say the thing where Alex is saying that TV is soon to follow print, print's going to go down first. I think there's a big difference there, though, in that print, if you put one reporter from a wire service at the Supreme Court, then everyone in the world can pick up that reporter's feed or words or blog, et cetera, and cover the same event. But to go cover an NFL game, that's a really expensive production. So I think TV, we're just looking at things moving from the big set box in our living room onto the computer or a combination of those. You still have to have the networks to produce a lot of these shows.
Oh, I don't think that the networks are going to go away. I just think that they're going to change structure and that they'll probably, you know, it's going to be much more of an online experience. I just think that a lot of these shows and a lot of these cable networks, you know, really will do better in the long run.
Can I chime in real quick? I know one of the things you were talking about is that it's neat that you can change angles and stuff during the sporting events. We've had that ability on a lot of DVDs for 15 years now. Does anyone do that? Does anyone ever click on different camera angles or whatever?
I don't. I would really like to use it for football because a lot, if you're knowledgeable about a particular show or sport, sometimes you want to change angles so you can see, for football, for example, I want to see the whole field, I want to see how the defensive backs are moving, etc. But other than that, I never touch any of the different camera angles on the DVD. Never bothers me on TV. It's really just that one niche area that I want to see.
As someone, it depends on what the camera angles are, but as someone who works in film, you know, when they have the multiple camera angles where they're showing behind the scenes and so on and so forth, it's pretty obvious. If that's there, I will play with it because I want to see, you know, there's nothing better than watching a movie and being able to stop and say, how was that shot made? Mm-hmm. You know, it is the most fascinating thing in filmmaking.
Well,
but
DVDs.
I mean, what's great is when they build it into the actual DVD, and I'd be happy to pay extra for that because they don't charge extra, but they should because it's just so amazing to sit there and watch these. It's that shot, and then you watch the whole planning. Like, there's been a couple. I can't think of the shows, but where they have you click on it in that shot, and The Matrix, the original Matrix disc was probably one of the best ways. You'd see a little white rabbit.
Oh, the white rabbit where the white would pop up, and you could see a featurette.
And it would show you how that scene was made.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and it was just a great, a really really great educational piece. You know, on how that works. And so, but you're absolutely right. Very few people take advantage of those technologies. But I think like, for instance, creating interactive, clickable things, especially in nonfictional content, I think is going to be a very lucrative thing to do. And it's going to be much easier to do in, you know, online, especially as, you know, one of the things that we have to see, and I don't think we're going to talk about this much today, but is a standardization of some of the online players.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of mess out there. You know what I'm interested in? This conversation, I always like to solicit listener feedback that I can sort of refer to in a future edition. And what this conversation reminds me of, especially with the TV part, is I'm curious, excuse me, how many of our listeners watch their local TV station, not the network, but the local TV station. I mean, I know it's safe to say we don't. Okay. At least Alex and I don't. But I'm curious, if you do watch local TV, what is it that you're watching? So email me, daisywhitney@gmail.com, and I'll give the results in a future edition. But a couple weeks ago, the reason I bring that up is a couple weeks ago, we were talking about radio, and is radio a thing of the past? And I asked people to write in to me and kind of tell me how they use the radio. So I just wanted to share very quickly, because I'd promised people I would do that, some of the feedback that I had got. And I don't think this is going to be a surprise, but I think it's still worth noting. Most of the listeners who wrote in said that that radio is a thing of the past, that when they're in their car, which is, you know, where most people typically would listen to the radio, they're using their iPod. But a lot of people are still using the radio to find new songs. But I would say the majority of our listeners said what they use the radio for is NPR and baseball. And most of the time, they're just going through podcasts or music in their iPod library.
That's another linchpin issue, is that for me, the only reason that I still listen to the radio really is because All Things Considered and Morning Edition, when I'm driving, I can't download.
Because they're not available then?
They're protecting their stations. NPR is not. NPR has released it. Almost every other show that they do is downloadable. Those two are not, because they know what will happen. People like me
would never tune in.
And I listen to it on XM or whatever. NPR,
by the way,
now.
Radio is a perfect example of, we're just a metamorphosis in the tree of media. I mean, there was a time that if you wanted up to the minute, you know, whatever, if you wanted to know where the action was, it was radio. And radio didn't die. It didn't disappear. It found itself a new niche. And likewise, that's just what's going to happen with newspapers and print media, is they're going to figure out what works. And right now, they're trying to play a game that's already being filled better by internet. And that's, you know, it'll survive.
I think what's important is content creation or news reporting will survive. It's just the format that I think is the
thing. But news reporting is really at risk in general, because what does it take to be authoritative these days? It takes someone at an event or watching an event on TV, someone blogging about it. You know, what gets more hits, the Huffington Post or the New York Times? Which has more reliable news?
Yeah, but here's the thing, is that I have to admit that I'm very jaded in that area. And one of the big reasons is that for me, there was this break, and people have heard me talk about this on the show, so I won't say it too often, but or spend too much time on it. But I was in Zimbabwe during the 2000 elections. These were the biggest elections in Zimbabwe. It's the beginning of all the trouble that's going on right now. And CNN was down there reporting on it. So I'm in the same city in a foreign country that they're reporting on. I mean, within blocks of their crew. And what they were showing on air was so different than what I was experiencing that I literally stopped reading the newspapers for a year. I mean, and I never went back. I never went back to believing anything that I read or anything that I saw on TV. I saw it as a one angle. And that's what people should look at. It was simply one angle of what's going on, but not anywhere near the truth. I don't believe anybody anymore, because it was so far off.
I'm the exact same way, and I kid you not, I mean this in all sincerity, because I care, I bother, you know, whenever somebody, whether it's a local media outlet or a big deal like CNN, I always, you know, check them. I know what I said, because I was talking about myself, but literally the media, the print media, except for Daisy Whitney, batting zero on factually reporting stuff that happens at my show. They'll come out and they'll mix up two routines, or they'll draw an inference from something that didn't happen there. And literally 0% of all articles that have been written on me are 100% factually accurate. And at some point, after about 8 years of this, I was like, you know what? I don't know why it would be just me that they wouldn't get everything right on.
Brian, can you give an example? What sort of mistakes?
I lie about every interview I'm ever in, so no one really knows any of the truth. And you just make up crap as you go along. It works out pretty well. Yeah.
Well, and I think that this gets back into the issue, and we've discussed this a couple times on TWIM, that, you know, the thing that we find is that when we read an article about something that we have a lot of knowledge in. So when we read something that we really know a lot about, you read it and you go, this guy's an idiot. I mean, this guy has no idea, you know, what he's talking about. And right. then you read the article right after it and you go, wow, that's really insightful. You know, like you know, because it's an area you don't know anything about. You know, and so the thing is that it's not that it's that much more accurate. And I'm not saying that bloggers are as whatever, but I don't think that the difference is as big as reporters would like it to
be. Well, there was an interesting, and I'm not, my job here is not to, I'm not going to go all, you know, J school. I didn't go to J school. I studied art history. Anyway, I'm not going to go all J school and defend it, because that's not That's not what I'm here to do. But there was an interesting piece. I'm going to need to look it up and refer to it in our next edition that raised that very issue, Alex, and a story about, you know, how much are journalists really worth? I mean, there's this whole idea that of, you know, protecting the First Amendment, protecting society, the free press and all of that. But this article and Michael Learmonth at Advertising Age actually linked it up on Twitter. It was really terrific that went through sort of the actual economic value of the information and what is it that a reporter actually brings to the table. And it was a sobering piece. So I'm gonna get that and bring that into for us to talk about on another show. But it's something to think about, and it's something that I'm forced to think about a lot. And that's one of the things that I mean, just very briefly, it's one of the things that I've had to do in the last, you know, several years of my career is think, okay, can I just solely rely on being a reporter, or are there other things that I can do to ensure my own economic survival? Because just the pure ability to make a phone call and ask somebody a question, you know, isn't really enough anymore. And that's what right. I think you're all, you know, referencing in a broader
well, right. And I think of it as, you know, I'm a computer graphics person, and I think of a lot of times, I think of when we look at news gathering, I oftentimes think of it the way we think of what's called photogrammetry. So photogrammetry is a process by which when you take I can take a picture of a house, and if I take it from a couple different angles, very different angles, where there's some overlap of the house, but they are from, you know, 60 degrees or 80 degrees apart from each other, with two angles, and with more angles, I can model the entire house. I can rebuild what that looks like in 3D from a handful of photographs. But they're from different angles, you know, and they have overlapping information. And so in the way, for me, the way that I tie that back to reporting is I don't care how good the person is. I don't want one view of what happened in a certain event. I want four or five or six different views that overlap. They talk about the same event from people who have different backgrounds, who have different beliefs, who have different, and I want to see what, based on that, and all of them are inaccurate, but I believe that there is, but if you start looking at all of those, you can start seeing what's really going on.
Right.
You know, you can triangulate the information from.
You're basically saying that's the collapse of the editorial system of American journalism, and now the onus is on the reader, the consumer who's paying $6 for that copy, to put together multiple sources and decide for themselves what the case is. Used to be the job of the media. That used to be a newspaper
right.
person's job.
And I personally think that it's safer for all of us, for the reader to be more discerning and to not trust anything that they're reading. That I'm going to only look at one source. Don't trust Wikipedia. Don't trust you know, the New York Times. Don't trust CNN. Don't trust don't trust any of them on their face. Trust them when you have, and it's never been so easy to get all that information. It's never been so easy to accumulate 50 articles on a given thing and scan through them and see what they say.
Brian, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say that that effect of looking at one article and saying, well, this is poppycock, and then going on to the next article and deciding it must be true. Michael Crichton actually coined it. He called it the Murray-Gell-Mann effect, because Murray-Gell-Mann, a famous physicist, had that exact experience where he would read an article, and because he knows physics, he'd be like, well, this person obviously knows nothing about what he's speaking of, and goes on to the next article and decides it must, because it's about history instead, decides that it's factually accurate.
Well, it's like if you're looking up health information online, right? If you're sick, if somebody in your family's been diagnosed, if you're going to adopt a child, if you're going through in vitro fertilization or whatever it is, you could just find an online forum and take what people are saying, or you could balance that. You would probably, if you're serious about it, try to find articles from medical journals. You would go to the website of the clinic that you're attending. You would then look up articles as well in newspapers and magazines and so on. I mean, you would assemble that sort of myriad of sources. But frankly, you know what? Maybe people are and should be doing more of it on their own, because the reality is journalists aren't getting paid what they used to. So the fact is, onus is going to be the citizens to do more of that if they want to have an accurate reflection of their reality and their choices.
Well, and as someone who's been a quote-unquote journalist on and off for 20 years, you know, there have been many times when I am just ahead of the article that I'm writing. You know, like, you know, it's not like I'm writing from deep background. I mean, mostly what I write now, when I write for web or I write for a magazine, it is based on, I only do stuff that I know a lot about. And the reason I do that is because I'm too lazy. I don't want to do the research. I just want to do something that I know really well, and I can comment on something based based on my knowledge. But I think that there have been many times when I wrote something where I'm doing all the research and I might not be completely correct. You know, and there was definitely times when I've made mistakes. You know, and these are, you know, when I'm in areas and reporters, especially ones that are working, you know, for these areas where they're researching all of the stuff. And they do bring a breadth of information, you know, where they understand the context of what they're looking at. But a lot of times I think reporters have trouble. I know I have, of knowing all that information. And we have to, you know, I think it's great to see a great article, but then we want to see three other ones by other people about the same information. And that's what I typically do. I think that, and it's so easy. You know, you sit there and you go, you know, Google makes everything in 45 seconds. I can see 1,400 articles. I can pick ones from areas that I trust, by writers that I trust.
And I see Google News covering the same story, but you see two very opposite headlines, one over the other, clearly right, indicating somebody's opinion behind the piece.
Well, and I think that what's important is that I think as someone who is in the media, who does this, I think it's important for people to, if I'm going to build up, if I'm worried about my own survivability in this, I'm worried about people trusting me. I'm not worried about them trusting, you know, like the New York Times. If I'm writing for the New York Times, I wouldn't be worried about whether they trust the New York Times or not. I want them to trust me as a name, as a person, like that I am doing. I'm someone that they can trust, because there's a lot of people that I listen to. You know, I was going to buy a set of cameras, you know, last week. And Adam Wilt, who's a guru and a friend of mine on cameras, you know, sent me a private email going, he saw me saying I was going to buy these cameras. And I won't make fun of the cameras, but he said, have you seen the output? And he got into this technical kind of geeky, this is the problem with those cameras. And I stopped. I completely changed direction, because I trust.
Right.
When it comes to understanding technically how good a camera is, Adam Wilt is the best in the world. And so the thing is that when he sends me an email and tells me that, I know I don't have to look anywhere else.
Right. You
know,
that's at that point, all you know, need. You know, you've got your authority.
And so the thing is as individuals, this is something that as journalists we need to develop. You know, is you know, that this, it's a brave new world where we're not under the umbrella of an organization. People have to trust us as individuals that we're going to be doing the best we can.
And I hope that we are. So a couple other things. Again, like I said, it's not. I am deliberately choosing not to defend a profession that has been very good to me. But time spent watching online video is increasing a lot, but it's still only 1% of all video watching. A couple of interesting stories in Video News and Ars Technica that basically said that TV watching is at an all-time high of 153 hours on average a month, according to latest data from Nielsen. And while the time spent watching online video is growing phenomenally, it's still about 3 hours per month. The group it's growing the most for, not surprising, is 18 to 34-year-olds. They consume 70% more online video than the average. And, you know, we don't have to spend a ton of time on these statistics, but I think it's always good that we have our reality check here, that we're enmeshed in these worlds, but you know what's happening out there in the rest of
there are a couple of things that I noticed that really jumped out at me. One that I thought was the most interesting statistic is because when we all got TiVos, because we're all early adopters, we got TiVos, and at first everyone's like, you know, nobody's watching time-shifted media. And we're like, don't worry, just give it time, it'll happen. That was the most surprising statistic to me, that time-shifted TV was like, 1-2% or something ridiculously low. That one kind of depressed me. But regarding the online video, it should be noted that they did not count any file sharing at all, which to me sort of throws the whole thing out the window if you really want to know how much content people are watching on their computer.
Well, okay, that's fair to say, but most file sharing is probably going to be consumption of video that's not monetizable.
Well, that's true. But I mean, if what you want to evaluate is how many people are watching video on their computers, then you've got to include that. I mean, there's estimates as high as 50% of all internet traffic is BitTorrent. I mean, to just ignore that. And also, I think I'm a little bit down on Nielsen in general. Once we got picked to be a Nielsen family, and I actually did it.
You're a Nielsen family.
We were, and I totally gamed the system. We were a Nielsen family right after Cartoon Network got pinched for the Boston promotion they were
right,
doing.
Right, right.
Whatever. I was so angry about that that I just put that we watched nothing but Aqua Teen Hunger Force every night for a week and wrote that down and sent it in. So ever since then, I've just decided that I don't trust Nielsen anymore. I would rather trust the hard metrics of network data than believe anything. This goes back to what we were talking about as far as being skeptical of everyone and everything. It's like, I just don't believe it.
No, I think that's a good point. And you know, actually, that brings us to a question from a listener that I've been wanting to address for a couple of weeks now. This is a listener, Lon Seidman, who has an online television project, actually doing a local online news project. And he wants to know how to present view counts to advertisers. What should be public info and what should be proprietary? So, Brian, I don't know how much you get into this with the selling of your show, Scam School and Revision 3, or if that's more handled by those folks, but just kind of from where you sit, what is it that advertisers want in terms of view counts?
It's funny that you would ask that because I ran into that situation just last week with you. You asked how many views Scam
School. Oh, I did. That's true.
You know, and I see the numbers, but I don't know whether it was released to the public. And I ended up having to call the VP over at Revision 3 and say, I don't know what to tell people. What should I tell? By the way, did you answer on that?
I did get the answer from Jim, because actually Brian is on the TV Week in its final incarnation. It has been for several years doing an annual hot list, which is where it profiles 10 or so people who are 35 and under who we think are going to make significant contributions to the world of TV, new media, digital, and so on. So Brian was on the list. I believe the number that Jim Lauterbach gave me, CEO of Revision 3, don't hold me to this because I don't have my notes in front of me. I think it was close to 2 million in the first year of the show. About 2 million views.
2 million downloads of individual episodes? Or?
I think what we were talking about was I don't believe that was 2 million completed views for every single one, but you know, sort of people who'd watched enough of it. I think he had a separate figure, and I'd have to go back and ask Jim to be specific. Revision 3 is rare in that it gives completed views, that it shares its information with advertisers in a number of ways. Just the total completed views, because you know, look, some people can tune into Brian's show and you know, maybe they watch 2 minutes and maybe they sort of got enough and that's all they wanted, and some people watch the whole thing, and I think there's value to all of that. So I think that's why we see a company like Revision 3 presenting it in a couple different ways.
And
it's a major problem. I mean, I don't have 2 million people listening to every episode I put out, so that's a completely different level. But it's so hard to track. It depends on what company is hosting the files. I host half of my files over at Nevio and half of them at Libsyn, so that I can try and get some kind of some kind of measurement, and the numbers are all over the place. The exact same feed, same story, same novel, same content. Depending on what server I have it on, I'll get totally different numbers from those two companies. So it's a crapshoot.
I think to be accurate, I think we're talking about 2 million cum. We're talking total. not total downloads, not
per episode.
Yeah,
not
yes,
per episode.
Yes. In that case, that would be cum. You're right, and right. I will.
Oh,
get...
so that's all the episodes together for a year?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. So just to make sure that we don't have people sending us emails later.
Saying, I was going to borrow
2 million
from
a show.
Brian, that was sweet.
Yeah, 2 million.
Right. Yes. Good point, Alex. Yes. Two million for show, but 2 million over the course for all the shows.
Which is still an enormous number of downloads.
Hey, Brian, when you get to 2 million an episode, if you need a driver, right here, pal. I got a
driver. By the way, one thing I wanted to comment on: Revision 3 does something interesting. They actually track the number of viewer engagement in minutes. They actually calculate the total amount, because they also, a lot of with YouTube videos, when you're under 10 minutes, it's easy to say how many hits you've got. But when you are dealing with 90 minute content or 70 minute content, like an episode of the Totally Rad Show, then there's a difference between one view of a 70 minute program from beginning to end versus one hit of a YouTube clip of somebody getting kicked between the legs.
True. And on that note, we've got about 3 minutes left, and we're going to do, speaking of time, we're going to do our Blend Tech Your Business segment. So this is kind of like the power shoot 'em out. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. We're going to be fast, is my point. Okay, so Michael Carr is a listener for Trim, and he is the Midwest Corporate Sales Manager for Winding River and Trim Dim Jackets. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Oh, and incidentally, he wants to know our sizes, Alex, if we want jackets. So thank you. This is one of the nice benefits. Now that we really get to know a lot of our listeners and the products, Alex and I are getting a lot of free stuff, and we want
large.
More. Anyway, so family business designs and manufactures, sort of reversible outdoor wear, just revamped his website, wants to add a video component if possible. What ideas do we have out of the gate?
So I've got a quick one.
Go for it.
Real quick, I think it'd be hilarious just to go around and offer people just do a contest. Be like, you reverse your jacket, and we'll reverse our jacket. You look dumb. Our jackets are awesome. And just a quick view like that.
Yeah, I think, like that. You know, for me, I'm always interested in trying to develop a relationship with whoever's going to be buying it. So what I'd be looking at is the cross section of who buys our jacket. So the first thing I would do is try to put out, like, go to my past customers and try to get them to fill out, you know, some little questionnaire, so you can get some sense of where they come from and their backgrounds and what their interests are. And then I'd look for building shows that either build or sponsoring shows that fulfill that. You know, for instance, it could be, if they're doing outdoor stuff, it might be an outdoor show, like a little, you know, cool places to go on, you know,
great hikes
or whatever, and try to find people that are interested in watching, you know, watching that, because, and the idea is people will know that you're wearing the stuff. You don't have to say very much. You can just wear it.
Yeah, it's just a subtle branding message.
Yeah, and so I think for me, that's always the direction that I tend to go, is find that niche and then serve it, you know, and serve the niche that you want to work with, and you develop a relationship with them, and then they're buying from a friend. They're not trying to, you know, they're not just trying to find the cheapest price. They're not just trying to, you know, they're not randomly finding you. They're finding you because you've developed something, you know, developed a relationship with them.
I like that. That's cool. One is kind of like a viral ad kind of fun thing, like Brian talked about. And I like your branding idea too.
Both would be effective. Yeah. His is actually more short term. Mine's like plan a year and do it. You know, it's because a lot of people ask, you know, how do we get to a point where we have as many listeners or viewers as we have? And how do we, you know, when we launch new products, we sell a lot of product. And the way we do that is because we do things for years. I can tell you how to do it over 5 or 6 years. I don't know how to do it. You know, I think that Brian's suggestion is probably more accurate for something that's going to be a quicker hit.
So yeah, if you have something to jumpstart you, and then your longer term one. This is another fun one. I like this. I'm going to be curious what my panel has to say. So Dr. Mark Vopat, Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Youngstown State, wants to know how to brand a philosophy department at a college.
I actually know him.
He says, we're trying to increase the number of majors in our department. We have stats about how well our majors do on the GRE, LSAT, etc. But we need something more. How do you brand a philosophy department?
I think you've got to get some of the people in the department to literally, if the goal is let's bring in more high caliber students into the program, then get the faculty to go on and start live philosophizing, you know, get on there and do some philosophy, and maybe they can find some ways to apply it to what's currently going on, or even tie it into what is the hot YouTube video of the week. And then these people could go on and say, well, this is how this impacts society, etc., and try and tie in what people are watching, the people who are of the age to go to college, tie that in with your program, and it'd probably be a home run. You'd be at the head of the class.
That's a pretty clever idea.
See, that's like the smart way to do it. Like the Bryant way to do it would be to like have a YouTube video of a fist fight between Descartes and Socrates or something.
We have the smartest and most fun panelists.
Let's have Socrates kick Carl Jung in the beanbag. That's going to get a lot of views right there.
Exactly. Now you're talking my language.
See, it's sort of like Brian, did you take your kids to see Night at the Museum?
No, not yet.
Oh, okay. Well, did you see the first one? I like that movie. I took my kids to see the sequel a couple weeks ago. It was pretty silly, but they have this goofy thing with Einstein bobblehead dolls. Anyway, there's a lot of goofiness in that movie. I think anybody who has a silly sense of humor like me will get a kick out of it. On that note, Brian, where can people find you?
You can check my website at schwood.com, S-H-W-O-O-D.com. And, of course, we have new episodes of Scam School every Thursday at scamschool.tv.
And so go add to those 2 million views. And, Scott, where do you want people to find you? And especially, what book do you want them to buy when they finish listening to this episode?
Well, first of all of my stories are available as free unabridged audiobook podcasts at either scottsigler.com or podiobooks.com, which is podiobooks.com. Again, those are free. And a limited edition hardcover of The Rookie, which is suitable for young adult audience and adults alike, is at scottsigler.com/The Rookie. We're half sold out, just a month into it. Probably about another 5 or 6 weeks, those will be available. So go get some now. And they make excellent Christmas presents.
I like that. Alex, where do you want people to find you?
You can find me at pixscore.tv. And if you want to find me on the Twitter, it's just Alex Lindsay, all one word.
And I also use my name on Twitter, Daisy Whitney. And that, big surprise, is also my URL, daisywhitney.com. And I'm doing a lot of writing and reporting for Beat TV now that I have segued away from TV Week. So you can check out my reporting there on a regular basis, beet.tv. And we are over and out.
we just jumped right out of there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a fun episode. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, guys, Scott.
Were awesome. Hey, thank you so much for having us on.
I liked it. That was a good show.
Fantastic. Yeah, really appreciate it.
We'll have you both on again.